my attitude is that it's generally well-intentioned in the beginning, but it quickly grows a bit tiresome. So I'm going to take the analogous posture here of functorial correctness. Probably you'll all have the same opinion of it, but the point is that some of the results I want to state are most cleanly stated in a purely categorical language, and large parts of the proof can be executed that way. And, well, sometimes if you want to discuss an object but you don't really know what this object's supposed to be, you don't want to go out on a limb and conjecture a possible definition, you can often get around that if you know how this object is supposed to relate to all the objects that you already know. So that's somehow the point. Okay, so every talk is supposed to contain a statement of a comprehensible theorem. So I'm in the process of writing it on the board, although the fact is we won't return to this theorem till three quarters of the way through the talk, because I'm going to have a whole bunch of categorical preliminaries where I'm more or less defining the terms of this. But I do want to have this up here for reference. Okay, so it's all about this. So, ignore the fancy words here, but consider the bidirected system of non-expansive linear maps of Banach spaces, most of which will be defined in the course of the talk. But which Banach spaces are they? Well, first of all, the system I'm discussing is associated to what you might call an inverse system of compact Riemann surfaces. Namely, take your favorite compact Riemann surface and make it hyperbolic so that life is interesting, and consider necessarily compact Riemann surfaces you obtain as finite holomorphic covers. Okay, and that gives you what's called an inverse system. Now, if that the system business bothers you, you can think of an inversely directed countable chain, and in fact, one loses no generality in this sense by doing that. Each of these Riemann surfaces has associated to it a number of Banach spaces of interest, and the ones of interest to me are the Banach spaces of holomorphic quadratic differentials. So, now for those of you who don't know what a holomorphic quadratic differential is, I'll probably mention briefly at some point what they are, and the relevance of them is somehow, well, it's part of a whole yoga that you either know or don't know, but I mean they are relevant to holomorphic dynamics via Thurston's theorem. Okay, so on each of these Riemann surfaces, there's some Banach space of holomorphic quadratic differentials. It's in fact a finite dimensional space, and it has an L1 norm. Okay, so the norm is actually important. And, well, these Banach spaces are not really thrown in at random. They're related to each other. Namely, given a covering in this system, let's say x beta up here, so my indices, I'll think of, you know, beta as sort of bigger or higher up. So beta's covering x alpha, and there are actually two related relations between these Banach spaces. Namely, I can sort of go up, in some sense, include the differentials on x alpha into the ones on the bigger surface by some sort of pullback. Actually, there's a rescaling involved. This is rescaling, it's rescaled pullback. But I can also go down. I can sort of average. This is push forward. So in fact, between any two Riemann surfaces in this diagram here, I have a pair of such maps. So there's a profusion of indices. I should be calling this I alpha beta and pi alpha beta. And the point is that there's some compatibility between the I and the pi for a given alpha beta, namely that, let's see, to go up and then go down, you get the identity, just by definition of these operations. But there's also some compatibility, some coherence, when you sort of compare successive stages of the tower, which is what amounts to saying that we have a, bidirected system. Now, I'll define bidirected system formally in a bit, but let me finish the statement of my theorem here. Okay, so consider the following bidirected system. Okay, and I said rescaled pullback. Okay. And if you want to do it in LP, you rescale in a different way. Okay. And consider the associated dual system. Now, in fact, I could specify what these things mean more concretely, but actually, I just want to be categorical about it. So building in as little, putting in as little, whatever as possible. Okay, so just define the B spaces as the Banach duals of the A spaces, as Banach spaces. So this has a norm, which morally is some kind of an L infinity norm, because I've taken an L1 norm here, but at this point, this is just some construction I could apply to any such chain of Banach spaces. So implicit in this claim is that if I dualize this, I get another such system. In fact, what's interesting is that the adjoint of the pullback map becomes the new projection map, and the adjoint of the previous projection map becomes the new pullback map. So each such bidirected system of Banach spaces will yield another such system by dualization. Okay, and finally, let, and here's something I'll need to discuss. I'm just going to write, let script A be the so-called direct limit of the A spaces, and correspondingly script B, the direct limit of the B spaces. And there's a whole lot of discussion built into what I mean by direct limit, because exactly what category I'm taking this direct limit in makes all the difference. Okay, and there's also a little bit about the word V, which makes some difference. Okay, but let me finish the statement of the theorem. So then, and I have various claims here. These are just sort of sample claims I can pull out. But then, well, how about zero here? So script A and B are separable. Well, that's actually no big deal. In fact, I just threw that in this morning just to make that point. Point one is neither A nor B is reflexive. That's my real point. And then an amplification of this is that neither of the canonical isometric inclusions, so script A into the dual of script B, or script B into the dual of script A, are surjective, or are isomorphisms. Roughly speaking, neither of these spaces is the dual of the other. But that's an imprecise statement categorically, and this is a precise statement. So implicit in this is the claim that, in fact, there are such canonical isometric inclusions, blah, 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 and, well, that has to be discussed. Okay, so here's a statement of a theorem. Yes? Yes, but I didn't say anything about it. An inverse system of covers of Riemann surfaces generates compatible direct and inverse systems of these Banach spaces. And in fact, I'm not going to actually deal with the covers directly except via these function spaces.
So you're taking a direct limit via the z-scale pullback?
Well, yes, yes. The point is, in the proof of this, I'm going to be considering at the same time the inverse limits along pi and comparing them, but then that would have led to a longer statement. But roughly speaking, yes, an inverse limit of Riemann surfaces will yield a direct limit of Banach spaces. Now, A and B are Banach spaces. I have to say, when I get to, by definition of direct limit, this happens in a category. If it happens to be a category of Banach spaces, the script A and script B will automatically be Banach spaces. Okay, but I'm getting ahead of myself. So let me now start discussing this, because there's a lot of undefined terms here, and a lot of this has to do with what these terms mean. Okay, so categories. Go over here. What is a category? All right, well, categories. A category has two things. It has objects, and it has morphisms between them. All right, so given, for example, object A and B, there's some set of morphisms. So if the category is called C, then there's just some set of things which are called morphisms, and we make absolutely no commitment about what they are. They needn't be maps, although for us they will be. Morphisms from A to B. And what's required is that morphisms which should compose do compose. So, for example, if I have objects A, B, C, and morphisms, F, G, going from here to here, then then there's a morphism. Well, there's a rule of composition yielding a morphism called G following F that goes from G from A to C such that that little triangular diagram commutes. Okay, so examples of categories. So examples. All right, well, so there's the category ALS of sets and mappings, otherwise known as the category of sets. Okay, there is, well, you can have topological spaces together with continuous mappings. You could have, oh, I don't know, Riemann surfaces and holomorphic mappings. You could have, say, Riemann surfaces and holomorphic covers. These two have the same object, but different collections of morphisms, and they do count as different. Okay, more to the purpose of the lecture here, you could have for any field K, you have the K vector spaces and the K linear maps. If you take any field K, if you take K to be, well, say R or C, you can have the appropriate Banach spaces and the continuous linear maps, or the bounded linear maps, same thing. Say continuous linear maps. And there's one more, really the whole story is about. You could take the K-Banach spaces and the what are generally called non-expansive linear maps between them. So by definition, a linear map between Banach spaces, V and W, will be said to be non-expansive and a morphism of this category precisely when its norm as an operator between Banach spaces is less than or equal to 1. So such a mapping is certainly a bounded linear operator, therefore continuous. So this is a subcategory of this category in the sense that every object here is an object here and every morphism here is a morphism here, but it's not a full subcategory. A full subcategory would be one where the morphisms here and here were the same for objects in both categories. So we have fewer morphisms here. So again, this has to be remembered whenever I talk about these definitions. Okay, so I have said non-expansive linear maps of Banach spaces, so subject to giving a definition of what direct limits are in an arbitrary category, I have defined these objects, well, at least up to canonical isomorphism. Okay, so what are direct systems and direct limits? Okay, so a direct system in a category is given by, well, first of all, it's some indexing-directed set with a partial ordering. Okay, and this is said to be a direct system if given A and B, given alpha and beta, there exists a gamma such that gamma is beyond both, it's greater than or equal to both A and B. No, excuse me, that's an inverse system. Wrong page. Just twiddle the arrows for the other page. I see. I seem to have photocopied that page twice. Well, no matter. Okay. So direct system consists of the following data. First of all, there's some underlying indexing set, which is supposed to be a directed set. And hold on. I want to make sure this is right. Yes. The way my ordering is defined, this is right. No, it's not. Well, it'll be. No, directed system. These are not. This is ascending unions. Okay, maybe just reverse the indexing. It depends what you want to call covariant, what you want to call contravariant. Do I have this? Hold. Okay. Let me take. Well, yeah. I just want to hold on. Let me write it down. Right. Direct systems. There exists gamma, alpha, beta. Oh, sorry. Yeah. No, that's right. Look, I'm writing this here. In other words, here's alpha and here's beta. Okay. And greater than means there's an arrow from the greater to the smaller, okay? And a directed system is a system where I can find a gamma so that any alpha and beta both feed into that gamma. Okay, that will satisfy people. Okay, I mean, different books put the arrow flipping in a different place in the discussion. Okay. The arrows go decreasing according to this definition, this specification of the ordering. Okay, this is just all about the indexing set. So a directed system consists of objects in the category. It's a directed system in a category, of course. So objects in the category indexed by these, together with morphisms, with a morphism for each beta, let's see, for each beta greater than or equal to alpha, okay, so for each diagram like this, we'll have a morphism from x alpha to x beta that could be called, say, I from alpha up to beta. Yes? Yes, what? Have I reversed my indexing again?
Yeah.
Okay, all right, so, okay, then. Okay, let's keep myself from losing time here. Let me figure out what my convention is. I must have forgotten it. Okay, so I want to be including down to smaller ones. Okay, so therefore, okay. Now, therefore, thank you very much. I want this to be like so. Yes, I want to include down to smaller ones. So I want to go like this. So I want to include up to bigger ones. All right. For each, let's not worry about what directed means, okay? For each beta greater than or equal to alpha, I want a morphism from x alpha to x beta. A directed system will be putting in the inequality here so that you get a coherence in that direction. The key property about these morphisms is that they should be coherent in the following sense. First of all, for alpha equals beta, I should get the identity on alpha, on x alpha, and for gamma beyond greater than or equal to beta, greater than or equal to alpha, we should have a certain diagram commuting which is easier drawn than written. So let's see, if I have x alpha and x beta, and x gamma, so I've got I alpha beta like so, and I beta gamma like so, and I could go I alpha gamma like so, and this diagram's supposed to commute. Such is a direct system. Okay. An inverse system is much the same thing, except, that the indexing set is supposed to be inversely directed rather than directed. Now, managed to bollock that up so much that who knows if the arrow is right, but whatever the arrow is, reverse it. So I believe an inverse system should be one such that, say, given any alpha and beta, there exists a gamma preceding both. So I don't know which direction I'm drawing my arrow. My relation, but I'll indicate the arrows as I intend to. That's what I mean. Okay, and then given such an indexing set, again, we're giving ourselves objects in the category, and for each say beta leading to alpha in the category, we have a morphism now going x beta down to x alpha that I'll call, say, pi alpha beta, such that the appropriate diagrams here commute, namely x gamma going to x beta going to x alpha, or I could go straight, and the implied mappings, the appropriate pi's here, yield a commutative diagram for any such triple. Okay, so that's the definition of an inverse system. Finally, what is a bidirected system? Well, bidirected system is something indexed by an indexing set which is simultaneously directed and inversely directed. So you can follow any two things. There's like sort of a soup and an inf for any pair of elements. And such that you have appropriate I's going from X's to bigger betas, from alphas to bigger betas, and appropriate pi's going from bigger betas down to little alphas. with an appropriate compatibility relation, namely that when you go up by alpha and down by a pi, you get the identity. So for any alpha and beta, I could either go up or go down, and if I do it in this order, I'm supposed to get the identity. Such a gadget in a category I will call a bidirected system. I don't know if that's standard terminology. I actually never heard of it before, but that's what we have here. Okay, so directed systems and so on and so forth. Now, what about directed limits? So if I'm clever, I can do this without erasure. So consider a category and consider a directed system. Can't do this without erasure. Oh, here, yes, I can. Consider a directed system of objects, and let's define what it means for an object in a category together with appropriate morphisms to that object to be a direct limit of a given direct system. So a direct limit is by definition a Y in the category, okay, together with for each and an implied, well, and a particular mapping, a particular, morphism. For each alpha, we have a morphism from X alpha to Y, which, to be pedantic, let's denote by script I alpha. And, well, it's required that these be compatible with the built-in relation between the I's. You want to think of Y as somehow being X infinity, so that, well, for example, every one of the triangles here commutes, if that's I alpha and I beta. Well, that's half the definition. Okay? Y is said to be a direct limit if, given any Y hat, together with I hat alphas also satisfying such a property. With compatible things into Y hat. All right, so that might be down here. I've got a Y hat. And I've got like so, and like so, and like so. Given any such Y hat with compatible things, then there is a unique morphism in the category from Y to Y hat such that the diagram commutes. Hold on. Do I want the other one? Yes, I do. No. For inverse limits, I go in. No. That's terminal object, so I was right. Yeah. Yeah, that's fine. Okay. So notice by this type, some artifacts of this definition are, first of all, I'm making no claim that direct limits do exist. Whether they do or don't depends very severely on the category. Secondly, as far as uniqueness goes, well, if everything is sort of as unique as it possibly can be given the formulation, namely unique up to canonical isomorphism, unique up to unique isomorphism within the category, but you can't really expect things to be any more unique than that, just by virtue of the definition. Okay, now I can define what an inverse limit is more quickly. You sort of do the same thing. You now consider, so for an inverse limit, well, inverse limit over here is going to be a y together with a family of pi's from the y to the various x alphas. Okay, such that given any y hat, which also comes together with such appropriate mappings here, there is a morphism, in fact, a unique morphism now going from y hat to y, such that all the diagrams commute. That's an inverse limit. Again, inverse limits don't necessarily exist, but if they do exist, then they're unique, up to unique isomorphism. Right. Okay. Moving right along. So, suppose you happen to be in a category which contains a bidirected system, and suppose that the forward maps admit a direct limit, and the backward maps admit an inverse limit. Well, what, if anything, can you say about the relation between these two limits? This is perhaps the first interesting, well, the first possibly contentual statement in the talk. So lemma, all right, so if, I'll just write this sort of brief with abusive language here. So if the direct limit exists, so lim in that direction is supposed to represent any particular choice of direct limit with implied mappings of the X alphas into such. This will be the direct limit over the I's. And if the inverse limit over the pi's exist, this is for a bidirected system. Okay, then there is a canonical morphism from the direct limit to the inverse limit. Now, what I mean by canonical, I mean this is the type of thing that people who play games of categories would know and might be confusing to others, but I mean this is really an abbreviation for a more formal statement, which would be essentially saying take y with implied mappings to be any direct limit and z with implied mappings to be any inverse limit. Then there will be a specification of a morphism with this property, and then the final clause saying, moreover, given any other such direct limit and inverse limit, there is a canonical isomorphism such from bound. Now that's just the square commutes. Okay, but let's just leave it like this. Okay, the proof, I don't think I have time for the proof, although maybe it'd be nice to illustrate how these things go. So essentially, we use the universal property and only the universal property because, of course, I've not given you a definition of direct and inverse limits as, say, sets with structure because we aren't dealing with sets of structure. So basically what you do in the proof is you say, well, how do I get a mapping from the direct limit to anything? Well, by the universal property, I need a coherent family of maps from the individual X alphas to that thing. That gets me halfway there. How do I get a map? How do I get a morphism from, say, X alpha into an inverse limit? Well, what I need to do is specify a coherent system of mappings from that X alpha to the various things generating the inverse limit. And I just have to write down what these mappings are. And the point is that for any X alpha, how am I going to map X alpha to the tower of all X betas? Well, for the betas below alpha, I'll go down by the projection. Okay, for beta equals alpha, I'll just go over by the identity. And for betas above alpha, I just go up by the so-called inclusion. And the point is that this yields a coherent system because of the hypotheses on a bidirected system. This yields something which is coherent enough so that the implied mapping, well, either way you do it, either from X alpha into the inverse limit, from X alpha into the inverse limit exists. And then those mappings, as a result of the coherence of these diagrams, one induces coherence of the mappings from X alpha, various X alphas to the inverse limits, and that induces such a mapping. Okay, and that's a little bit pedantic, but that's somehow the whole point, is that you can replace contents with pedantry. Right. Okay, now, let's actually do something. All right, so I want to give some quick illustrations of direct and inverse limits in familiar contexts, just for you to realize that there's something that you know already that you can touch base with here, and then sort of apply this discussion to a particular category, namely the Banach spaces with non-expansive mappings, and that's where the terms here come up. And then, in some sense, the theorem at that point can be almost completely read off from the category. Well, you can read off all but the part with content from the business with the arrows, and then we can isolate the part with content, which turns out to be some fairly elementary or standard geometric observation about how quadratic differentials go up and down for compact Riemann surfaces. And this will turn out to be parallel to something that maybe we all find much more familiar from our study of functional analysis early in graduate school. Okay, anyway, so what about direct limits for sets and mappings? All right, so for sets and mappings, the direct limit, and I mean, again, the word is not really an appropriate word, but whatever. Direct limit is, okay, well, you take the disjoint union of the objects, and then you identify things which should be identified. So, for example, you identify an element little x alpha with its image in, say, a larger x beta. So you consider the equivalence relation generated by these elementary statements here, and you collapse by that. Now, if the mapping, say, from x alpha to x beta is just an injection so that you can regard this as an ascending union, then the direct limit, in fact, is the ascending union. For inverse limits, well, this is or can be described as the set of coherent backward chains okay, and then there's a claim that there's a conical mapping, a conical morphism from direct limit to the inverse limit, which in fact, well, I'll leave it to you to think about, work out what this is as an exercise. I'll do another case where it's sort of easier to say. It's not that this is hard, but the other thing is easier. Okay, how about vector spaces? We actually work with vector spaces more often than we work with sets, so even though this involves extra structure, it'll feel more comfortable. All right, so again, for say, k vector spaces and linear maps, okay, direct and inverse limits exist. And, well, I could describe, since I've already discussed what things are in the category of sets, turns out, I mean, if you have a subcategory of another category, then there's a sort of a map, a morphism in one direction between the direct limit for one and direct limit for the other. So suffice it to say, I can take advantage of the fact that I've already discussed. Yes?
The inverse limit of
a diagram of set. It's the subset of the product. Okay, so an inverse chain here is by definition an element of the product. I didn't actually say that. But
okay.
Yeah. In fact, I mean, that's a good general point. I mean, roughly speaking, in any category, well, roughly speaking, morally, direct limits are appropriate quotients of direct sums. And inverse limits are appropriate subsets of direct products. But of course, the notion of quotient and subset don't make sense in an arbitrary category. But there is a way to juice that statement up to say that in a category that admits arbitrary direct sums, which are definable in categorical terms, and equalizers or co-equalizers? Co-equalizers. There are abstract conditions playing games with arrows that really reduce this down to one finite construction plus direct sums yielding direct limits, and one finite construction together with arbitrary products yielding inverse limits. But I can barely remember the statement, let alone, that's not really the point. But roughly speaking, quotients of direct sum, of direct unions, and subsets of products. Okay, now for vector spaces, so we could sort of use that yoga, but why don't I just take advantage of what I've done here. So the vector space here, I'll write the vector V lim for vector space direct limit. This works out to be, or you can take a model for this if you like, as the linear span of the direct limit we just built for sets. Of course, the claim here is that if you form this object, then it satisfies the universal property characterizing direct limits, and of course this has to be checked. Okay, but it works. And the inverse limit, well, for the inverse limit, turns out that if you take the inverse limit of sets, which happen to be vector spaces, and if the maps between them have, then you can actually transport or pull back the operations, the vector space operations, to the set direct limit. So with induced sum and scalar multiplication, it just works. Okay, and in fact, what's this canonical morphism? Well, I'm just going to cheat a little bit and assume that I'm dealing, for example, in the case where the mappings I are actually just inclusions, injectives, so that I'm really dealing here, if you think about it, that would just be saying take the ascending union of the entries here. And the point is, if you start out with the system, say, R, well, say, K, K2, K3, or K is the field, et cetera, where the mappings going up are, say, inclusion where you sort of pad by zero, so x goes to x comma 0, xy goes to xy comma 0, et cetera, and the mappings in this direction are, forget the last coordinate, then in a suitable sense, the direct limit is the countable direct sum of counting many copies of the field, and the inverse limit is the direct product. Remember, the direct sum is given by all sequences, all infinite sequences, such that all but finitely many of the entries are zero with implied coordinate-wise operations, and the direct product is just all sequences with implied operations. And certainly, this one maps canonically to this one, and in fact, it's actually an inclusion, which I have not claimed here because I'm not sure exactly what assumptions I need to do that in general. Okay, so this is supposed to be a familiar example of what this morphism is supposed to be, and I hope this is reasonably clear. Okay, moving right along to Banach spaces. Okay, now, for the purpose of this discussion, the category of Banach spaces and continuous linear maps is actually rather dodgy. All right, so for Banach spaces with continuous linear maps, well, I'm just going to give you a particular example. In fact, it'll actually be a bidirected system, and the same system will fail to have a direct limit and also fail to have an inverse limit for sort of dual reasons, dual and similar reasons. And the example, well, it's actually this example, pretty much. But let me write it up here. So here, I'm going to work over C. This is a holomorphic dynamics conference. So we've got C, we've got C2, we've got C3, etc. And the maps going down are, say, X1, X2 goes to X1, X1, X2, X3 goes to X1, X2, etc. And up here, it's X1 goes to X comma 0. Of course, if I go up and I go down, I do get the identity. Right, and so it's in fact the same diagram as before, but I'm going to consider this diagram now within the category of Banach space and continuous linear maps, which means when I'm discussing or trying to find direct and inverse limits, the available things that serve to compare with the potential direct limit are what has changed as I've moved from this category to this category. Okay, and well, I'm 99.99% sure. Well, okay, interesting. Okay, interesting question and even more interesting answer. Very good that you asked. I should be talking about Banach spaces, so I should put in the norms. So I'll just say, why not put in, say, the L infinity norms? But in fact, it doesn't actually matter because, of course, an object in the category, if I take any two finite dimensional vector spaces, any two norms are equivalent. Therefore, no matter what norm I put down, what writing down C determines this object up to an isomorphism. It is... That's the proof that this doesn't exist. On the other hand, it cannot, it should not, because by definition, if you think about the universal property, by definition, it has to be unaffected by any coherent collection of bounded operators. On the other hand, if the bounds on these isomorphisms to some other description, if these bounds go to infinity, that pretty much kills your chance of getting a direct limit. And that's morally the argument. Okay, one needs details for that. So as I said, I'm 99.99% sure. I have a little worked that out at 4 in the morning one day. So let's just say that the direct and inverse limits don't exist for this example. Of course, there are examples where they do exist. If I just took, say, an C isomorphically by some isomorphism to C, but whatever, then no matter what those isomorphisms were, there would be a direct limit. It has to do, again, with the fact that it's not... Maybe Banach is the wrong word. Maybe Banachable is the right word. But that's... Are you satisfied?
No.
Okay, so precise your objection.
There's a sense in which projective limits want to exist in the category of complete topological vector.
Yes, but we're not in the category of complete topological vector spaces.
Projective limits should not exist at all.
Well, okay. Okay, so I haven't contradicted any of that, have I? No. So now I'm going to... No, I know exactly what you're saying, and I don't believe I've contradicted any of it. I had all this in mind. Try out my example. I don't have time to go through the details of this, but the point is, no matter what norm I put here, there is an isomorphism. All the diagrams commute, so I would actually have to have an isomorphism between the limits. But you're right. The dependence on the norm becomes rather severe when you pass to the limit, and therefore it could not be unique up to isomorphism. Therefore, it ain't there. That's my proof. Okay, moving right along. So this is not the sense in which I mean in the theorem. Now, I did say non-expansive maps. Now, it happens that there's another category of Banach spaces where I restrict to the morphisms which are non-expansive. Now, this is, by the way, not my invention. I mean, I've been playing games with this thing off and on for years, and at some point I found some functional analysis book where people were, a guy was actually discussing things in these terms, and the other day I typed Banach space category non-expansive, and there's certainly a flourishing literature of people doing various things. So, whatever. Okay, let us now look at the category, and for the remainder of the talk, for like the whatever epsilon minutes that remain, now I've got like, eight, what do you mean 8 minutes? Oh, you're right, all right. All right. Have to end on a good questionable point here. So Banach spaces with non-expansive maps, well, I've defined what this category is. So I'm going to say, so there's a lemma or proposition, how was proposition. In this category, direct and inverse limits do exist. Furthermore, the canonical map, which we already know exists, furthermore, the canonical map, so of course, this, if I have a bidirected system in this category, then I have both a direct limit and an inverse limit. And I've already claimed that there's a canonical map from one to the other. And the claim now is that this canonical map is actually is an isometric inclusion, which makes life interesting. Now, this claim here that these direct and inverse limits exist, I mean, this has to be proved. Now, I could, I suppose, if need be, give a direct proof that products and sums exist and figure out what an equalizer and co-equalizer is and then invoke the whatever existence theorem for limits and co-limits, but what the hell, why don't I just give you an actual concrete description you can verify at your leisure that these are direct and inverse limits, because it's this description that's sort of interesting, and to be honest, that was my starting point before I kind of hid it in all this functorial verbiage. Huh? The statement is not categorically correct. There's no categorical meaning to this statement here. So this thing exists for categorical reasons, and this is a description of it in the language of Banach spaces. Yeah, I'm not quite sure I know how. I don't know if I know how to axiomatize this argument, and I'm not going to bother trying. Well, okay. A correct statement here would be that this is monic, but I am not claiming that in any category the canonical map from here to here is monic. I don't know if it is or not, but I'm not claiming that, but here it is. Okay, so what are the direct limit and inverse limits going to be? Okay, so let me make life mildly simpler by just assuming, for example, that that doesn't matter. Okay, so lim direct of X alpha, what's this going to be? Well, morally it's supposed to be something associated to sort of a union. Well, for vector spaces, the union would be the linear span of the set theoretic direct limit, except I don't get a Banach space that way. Well, gee, maybe I should complete. So if you take the vector space direct limit and you, as a pseudo, in fact, normed linear space, so I have to tell you what the pseudo norm will be, whatever, then complete. The result of that is what turns out to be the direct limit. Now, what do I mean by regarding this as a pseudo-norm linear space? So if I have an element of the set theoretic direct limit, well, because of what happens in the category of vector spaces, I can already sort of, this is the direct limit for vector spaces now. So something here comes in the span of things that came over from here. So if I have an element little x alpha, as an element of this Banach space here, it has a norm. And now if I move it over a little bit farther to x beta, then the image of that, I beta alpha of x alpha, has a norm. And because this is the category of Banach spaces with non-expansive linear maps, this norm is greater than or equal to that norm. Therefore, the system of these norms, the sequence, if I've chosen a countable number, is non-increasing and therefore tends to a limit. The limit, which may well be zero, is by definition the pseudo-norm for that appropriate object in the vector space direct limit. I then complete the pseudo-normed linear space, and the completion of such a space automatically includes the modding out by the things of norm zero, and that gives me a Banach space. That is my direct limit. If the mappings here happen to be isometric inclusions, this can be more simply described as take the ascending union and complete. Take the ascending union, the norms are compatible and complete. Okay. What is the inverse limit? For the inverse limit, well, an element of the inverse limit for the vector space inverse limit is a coherent backwards chain of stuff, of things, and each of these has a norm. And now, because I'm going backwards, the sequence of norms is non-decreasing, which means it may or may not tend to infinity. Consider the ones whose norms do not go to infinity. Take that subset. That is, first of all, a linear subspace of this. And if you take the limiting norm as the definition of the norm, one can check that that makes that subset a Banach space. That is, or it turns out to be, or can be verified to be, the inverse limit, a description of the inverse limit in the category of Banach spaces with non-expansive maps. How much more time do I have? Okay, all right, I've gotten like a halfway through the talk, so I'm not going to really be proving anything, but I've defined most of the things. So let me just, the rest I'll just write down various canonical things. Okay, so within this category, there are various interesting games that one can play. I don't have to specialize for that. So suppose now that I have a diagram, let's call them A's, A alpha, A beta, within this category, this particular category. Okay, and suppose I dualize. Okay, and again, with reversing the roles here, I still get maps going up and down. Okay, and over here I have both a direct limit and an inverse limit, and over here I have a direct limit and an inverse limit, so let's call the direct limit script A, and over here let's call the direct limit script B. We already know that for either one of these, the direct limit canonically injects into the inverse limit, and there's a rather amusing thing that comes, so the duality is rather amusing. So what if I want to take the dual or work out a description of the Banach space dual of the direct limit? Okay, so in such a situation, so there are canonical isomorphisms. Well, let's see. So the direct limit dualized is canonically isomorphic to the inverse limit of the duals. Okay. And furthermore, this fits together with the direct and inverse limit business as follows. This is universal. This is universal. This is well, it's a universal property of this particular category. I mean, the proof of this just uses the functorial definition. Okay, no, I have to. What do I use here? You use the fact that if you have a coherent system of linear functionals with bounded on an ascending collection of subspaces whose norms are bounded, then there's an induced linear functional on the limit. So you use that property of the category, and that's the property that fails in the category of Banach spaces. Okay, so in fact, there's actually sort of a quartet of spaces here. I can look at script A, which is the direct limit of the A alphas. I can look at script B, which is the direct limit of the duals. I can look at the inverse limit of the same A alphas, which turns out by this remark here to be functorial equivalent to the dual of this one over here. And similarly, I've got this one over here. Star. Okay, actually, it's slightly more complicated than that, but if I assume that the individual A alphas in the diagram are reflexive, say finite dimensional, then it will be exactly as I say. So let's assume that. So, and the point is that we have the canonical injection here, which is direct goes into inverse. Okay, and on the other hand, we have the identification of lim inverse to, we have this identification here, and so on. Now, I got like one more minute left, so let me state what this is in a case you all know, and then just reiterate my claim here, and then anyone who cares to ask me why that's true, I can explain later on. Okay, so here's a situation that you all know and love. This involves my four favorite Bonnex spaces, very old friends of mine, perhaps my only friends in this category. And I don't want to run over too much, but I do want to finish just specifying the example, and everyone will know it. So here, this is a sort of a toy model of this situation here. If we start off with x, say xn now, it'll be countably indexed. Xn will just be, say, z modulo 2 to the nz. The 2 here is just to choose something definite. Okay, so this is a set of 2 to the n elements. In fact, it's a group, which is kind of useful. And, well, there are mappings. If I have a big n to a small n, okay. Then I have a mapping like so, which is, say, reduce mod the 2 to the smaller 1 times n. Okay, and now what are going to play the roles of the a's? Well, consider the, say, complex-valued functions on xn with what norm? The L1 norm. So L1 of xn, which is, of course, just isomorphic to C2 to the n. Okay, and, well, it turns out that the dual of this, because everything's so explicit, I can regard this, in fact, canonically, as L infinity of the same xn's. So, of course, as vector spaces, L infinity of xn and L1 of xn are isomorphic, but as normlinear spaces, they are surely not, and when you pass the limits, things become rather different. Okay, what are the mapping, what are the inclusion mappings? I'll just have to say what it is for the A's because I get them by duality for the B's. So how do I include from Xn up to X to the N? Well, essentially, I pull back, right? If I have some function from 2 to the N points here to C, and I have a bigger thing here, well, if I compose with a projection, I get a function from here to C, but then I have, oh, am I doing this the right way? Yes, but then I have to divide. Yes, but then I have to divide. If I want this to be norm-preserving, then I should divide by... No, hold on. I have this backwards. I have it backwards. I have it backwards. If I talk about a measure, if I have a measure, L1 is really measures. If I have a measure of norm 1 here, and I want to induce a measure of norm 1 here, well, I can pull it back because it's a finite degree cover, but then I should divide it by the degree to rescale it. So I have pullback, so rescaled pullback. And going back down, I have push forward, which is, well, push forward or averaging or symmetrization or however you want to describe this. I have a measure down here. For a given point here, I look at the pre-images. I take the total measure above that pre-image, and I associate the sum of that to the point down there. And this yields a bidirected system in my Bonnex space. I can dualize to get a bidirected system. And I claim, and there's a little bit of measure theory, in fact, pretty much precisely the measure theory that I might know on a good day is what proves this, but it's nothing you all wouldn't know on a good day. We all took the same classes. So here's my quartet of spaces here, and I can tell you what they turn out to be canonically, assuming that you believe me. Script A, what should the direct limit of these be? Well, gee, if I'm talking about measures on things going up and up and up, if there were only some sort of object at height all the way up here, then it would just be the L1 measures with respect to, say, some natural measure class up there. Well, turns out what's the object here? It's a Cantor set. In fact, so if you take the inverse limit in the topological category of the Xn, you get a Cantor set. In fact, it's the dyadic Cantor set with a dyadic Haar measure. And if I take L1 of that Cantor set, that's what A is. What about B? Well, okay, so what's the dual at a finite level? It's the continuous, well, it's the functions, but after all, at a finite set, all functions are continuous. The dual of L1 is L infinity, so it would be the continuous functions with the L infinity norm, and I include those to the limit and complete. What should I get? Well, I should get the continuous functions on the limiting Cantor set. And how about these? What if I took inverse limit instead of taking a direct limit? Well, I know by the discussion here what I should really think about is take the direct limit of the duals and then dualize, and if I do that, I get the Borel measures with the total variation norm, and of course, L1 canonically, The absolutely continuous ones, with respect to any given measure class, canonically isometrically inject into that. And over here, what if I took the inverse limit instead of the direct limit? Well, gee, that's the dual of this. What's the dual of L1? It's L infinity. And there you go. All right. Take a look at this. None of these are reflexive Banach spaces. And there's a canonical mapping from A into B star, which is not an isomorphism because it ain't surjective. And same over here. And this is precisely the claim I'm making about up here. Now, the point is here, I can prove it easily because we sort of know, we can all write down fairly readily what these identifications for these limiting objects are supposed to be and then just verify it because we know, after all, that this is bigger than that. We can write down a particular, say, the Dirac measure that's not in here and so on and so forth. To prove the theorem here, of course, you have to do that all over again, because if I change the category, if instead of L1 here I did L2, I would actually get Hilbert space, the same Hilbert space, whether I went up direct or inverse. So there is something going on here. Okay, but the point is that by looking carefully at how you would show in this case that this is bigger than this, and then appropriately transporting and finding the corresponding consideration for L1 quadratic differentials, you can prove my statement here as well. Now, I've run over, so I better stop. Oh, why I'm looking at it. Oh, okay, okay. Well, that's like transparency number 28, right? So the point is, yes, that's my historical motivation. That's my actual motivation, and that's actually almost clear from the discussion here, because after all, these spaces here, the sort of toy version, was L1 and L infinity of some concrete spaces, and then pull back and push forward operations. Now, if instead of taking finite spaces, I play the game with Riemann surfaces, and you have to know what a Riemann surface lamination is. Riemann solenoid, but I mean, Sullivan defined these basically to be the inverse limits. It'll be an object which is a topological space which is locally a product of, say, a piece of a Riemann surface cross a Cantor set, say this Cantor set or something similar. And then it's of interest to determine what the appropriate Banach spaces are there. Now, why is that? That's because the quadratic differentials, right, because for Riemann surfaces, the holomorphic quadratic differentials turn out to be canonically pre-dual.